The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There's a balance, and you're not brought up in the same way you are as an American kid with what 1776 was all about, the overweening influence of the federal government, how you should push against that, what probable cause is, Entick and Carrington, if you're a lawyer. That doesn't really form part of our psyche. And because of that, we're happy to allow the government a good measure of discretion in what it does.
I'm David Chris, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, December 21, 2020. The United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland has been conducting and regulating signals intelligence, SIGINT, since before the United States was even born. And so I sat down with a brace of experts on UK SIGINT and SIGINT regulation to talk about how they do it across the pond. Michael Drury and Tony Comer are veterans of Government Communications Headquarters, GCHQ, the British counterpart to our own National Security Agency. Michael was GCHQ's first full-time legal advisor from 1996 to 2010, when he joined the private sector. And Tony was GCHQ's historian until his retirement earlier this year. They are, I believe, the most knowledgeable pair of UK SIGINT experts on the planet. And as you'll hear, they're also a lot of fun. We compare and contrast the US and UK experience with SIGINT, SIGINT regulation, popular support for SIGINT and intelligence in general, and also some cutting-edge issues, including how SIGINT works today, synergies between SIGINT and cyber, GDPR, encryption, and maybe even online harms. It's the Lawfare Podcast, December 21, 2020. Government agencies that really listen to you. SIGINT in the UK. Gentlemen, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, David.
Thank you for the invitation.
I'm very glad to have you and be with you. I've given a one-sentence introduction for each of you, but please tell our audience a little bit more about yourselves. Michael, why don't you go first?
Well, Tony's got a longer history, and started before me, which says something about my age. I joined in 1996 as GCHQ's first legal advisor. My predecessor, who was a wonderful gentleman and a part-timer, his capacity to understand SIGINT was perhaps not as great as his experience, the most notable element of which was he sentenced someone to be hanged. Whether that gave him an insight into the SIGINT world, I think is a matter of debate. So I joined in 1996 when the law, we're going to come and talk about the law, was, how shall I put it, rather more nascent than it is now, and saw it develop. Really from that state in 1996 through to 2010, in which time there were enormous changes. It wasn't all flashing lights and whistles. I did everything as the first time legal advisor. One of my first cases was how to deal with a neighbour of ours who insisted on throwing their dog mess into our grounds rather than having it litter their garden. So that was kind of the sort of thing I did. Although there were more stimulating elements to that. So 14 years before the mast, and during that time we saw the growth of data protection, the growth of international law as a result of Iraq in particular, and effectively the beginning of what is now an explosion in litigation challenging SIGINT and the law which underscores it.
Outstanding. So already at the very threshold of this podcast, We've covered hangings and dog mess. I like it. It bodes very well for the future. Tony, what about you?
I lack Michael's familiarity with both dog mess and public executions, but there we are. I studied Spanish and Portuguese at university, went off to be a teacher in Spain for a while, didn't enjoy it. And so went back to my university's careers office one summer holiday and said, what jobs are there for people who speak foreign languages, who don't want to be teachers and who don't want to work in London? And they said, we know where you can go, the Joint Technical Language Service. I applied to GCHQ without even knowing I was applying to GCHQ. I thought I was joining the Foreign Office's translation service and only found out some way into the process what I was getting involved with. I joined on the 10th of October 1983, and for me, it was like being at a theme park where every two or three years I was able to sort of change rides and do some really interesting things. I started off in intelligence analysis. I got more involved and I stopped being a linguist in lots of other parts of the intelligence process, in collection management and looking at policy. But most of my work across my career was about being involved in support to the British and Allied military, one way or the other. The British military, obviously, directly, allies through NATO. I was the UK rep on the NATO Signals Intelligence Committee for 6 years. And then in 2009, I became GCHQ's historian, which it was always going to be the last job I did. I'd decided some years previously. I didn't realize that my career would end quite as early as it did. But I spent 11 years as GCHQ's historian, during which time GCHQ decided to use that post as a sort of public face, as a talking head, as somebody who could actually appear in public and talk about the past as a way of illustrating some of the realities of modern SIGINT. 2019 was our centenary year. We had great fun celebrating 100 years of British SIGINT. And then this summer I retired and I'm now not shy, but retired.
Michael, do you think enough time has passed that we can tell Tony that he actually joined SIS and not GCHQ when he first applied? It may be safe to tell him. And Tony, on your watch, Professor John Ferris published a 800-something page tome, Behind the Enigma, the Authorized History of GCHQ, Britain's Secret Cyber Intelligence Agency. So that's a pretty major discussion of GCHQ's history that came out on your watch, if I'm not mistaken.
It is. The other two agencies in the UK issued histories when it was their centenary. We're in a slightly different position because I think a lot more is known about our history. We've released far more records into the National Archives of the UK. But it's still important, I think, that we've got somebody from outside to look at our history and tell our story in a way that somebody on the inside probably wouldn't have been able to.
Right. And one of the differences that I think maybe our relative career trajectories may illustrate is the sort of way in which I think, and you tell me if I'm wrong, it's more routine for U.S. intelligence officials, including lawyers and others, to sort of go through the revolving door back and forth between government and the private sector. Certainly, in my case, I've been in and out of the Justice Department a couple of times and have had ongoing involvement with the intelligence community from the private sector. If I'm not mistaken, that's much less ordinary and routine in the UK. So, Michael, I mean, most of the lawyers, for example, stay in for their whole careers. They don't come out and join the private sector. And if they do come out, they don't go back. Is that right?
I think that's absolutely right. And it's changing to some extent, but not in the way you see it in the US. So, I mean, there's reasons for that, mainly because people, I think, like working in the public sector. Secondly, it's because those public sector skills are not in the same way they are in the US valued by private sector firms who are different bodies. And in the national security context, there really isn't a body of national security law. So of national security lawyers, rather. So in the US, you go to the ABA National Security Caucus, and there's 3,000 lawyers there. In the UK, we could all stand in a small telephone box, and that will be enough room for those of us who are out, as it were. So it's a very different, it's a different in scale. It's different in terms of the way that people move back and forth. They're beginning to do that, particularly in the white collar crime field, in which I'm now partially involved, but it's just not normal. People stay in government for their entire careers. And I can think of maybe two or three people who've been in my position, gone into the private sector, but they're much more discreet about it than I am, who is happy to trade on my GCHQ background.
So is it fair to say, I don't actually know if this is fair to say, it seems to me, when I think about the sheer size of the Behind the Enigma book, that British intelligence has been perhaps more forthcoming about its operational history, but perhaps that the legal framework and the understanding of the legal framework by the general public may be less developed. Is that a fair sort of contrast? Or, I mean, as compared to the US, where I think the operational history, some of it is certainly out, but we don't have an authorized 800-page biography of the agencies. On the other hand, there's quite a lot of public discussion and much writing done on the legal rules that govern. So am I oversimplifying by sort of comparing and contrasting the US and the UK that way?
I don't know how to put this to two lawyers, but perhaps not everybody is as interested in the law, and perhaps more people are interested in history.
Tony,
I'm
this
sorry.
Is blasphemy, sir.
I'm sorry.
I take great exception to your remarks. You're on the Lawfare podcast. I invite you to mind your P's and Q's a little more carefully.
I shall rephrase that. I shall do henceforth. I think there is perhaps, it's a subject that we might get into later on anyway. I think our starting points are different. I think the way that people think of the law and lawyers, the way that people think of the way that the law regulates the way that government works is possibly different. I mean, as Michael said, we had no lawyers until the gentleman that he referred to at GCHQ, where we needed legal support. We could look either to the security service, MI5, or we could look to the Foreign Office. But there was little need. The processes by which we worked were simple and defined. So until you get into the 1980s, there's no specific legislation that regulates the way that GCHQ works, other than the regulations that affect all civil service departments. So logically, a book that's going to be looking at the way we worked isn't going to focus as much on our legal history as on our organizational and operational history.
That was diplomatically put, but for the record, I still feel denigrated and hurt. Michael?
Let me add to your hurt then, because it seems to me that the law, as far as signals intelligence concerned, indeed any other sort of element of government in some senses, is actually for saddos. Saddos are either employed by government like me, or, and I don't wish to denigrate them, but a small coterie of people who act for NGOs and pressure groups who see these as existential issues. Their views, I would suggest, are not typically either of much concern to the citizen, and I'm sure we'll talk about this in a bit, David, because the British population's attitude to spying and to covert intelligence, and particularly to SIGINT, and we benefit from the Bletchley Park legacy, and even if the professor does say it's overblown, Tony may want to come back on that, and we stand in good standing with the British public. So the law hasn't really impinged, and that's also a function of the fact, as Tony says, until the 1980s, there wasn't really any law. That's not to say that the people working at GCHQ did not act entirely properly. And one of the things I found when I went there in 1996 was just the scrupulous attention to detail and the genuine desire and, in fact, success in operating in a scrupulously ethical way.
At least after those first few hangings.
Well, you know, you've got to encourage, as it were.
So, yeah, I want to, we could go like 50 different directions right now from this. I mean, I definitely want to come back to the role of law, the conduct of intelligence in a legal vacuum, because we have a different experience in the U.S., I think, you know, until the mid-1970s and a resulting massive change. But so let me put a pin in that, and I know we will return to it. But Tony, you know, if we're going to talk about history, you guys have a lot more of it than we do here in the colonies. And maybe you can start us, if not at the absolute beginning, you know, in the Middle Ages, with some stories of early signals intelligence, as it were, in the pre-electronic era that characterized the way the British government did its work in this area.
I think it's a great shame that you don't want me to go back to the Middle Ages, because
you go ahead.
It's such a nicer place. Well, the oldest references that we have to interception go right back to the 1320s. You know, the king orders harbour masters to search boats coming into the kingdom to look for people carrying letters, and if they're found, to put the couriers into prison and to send the letters to the king's court so that they can be examined. During the Commonwealth, one of Cromwell's ordinances set up the post office specifically as a government monopoly, but one of the reasons for that was so that any letters being carried in the kingdom could be examined if necessary to see if it was bad people using the royal mail to plot against his authority. And at the return of the king, with the restoration of the monarchy, it was one of the first two or three of Cromwell's ordinances to be converted into acts of Parliament. And successive post office acts said that letters could be intercepted when warranted by a Secretary of State. So, you know, we have a long and honourable tradition of legally intercepting people's communications. The only time that it's gone badly wrong was in the first part of the 19th century, when the very specific rules about warrants having to be express warrants addressed warrants that said that an individual's correspondence could be intercepted rather than all correspondence between London and Venice. The government played a bit fast and loose with the rules, and this was discovered in 1844. And there was a great scandal at the time, which led for the rest of the 19th century to SIGIN almost being completely abandoned as a tool of state by the British government, certainly by the British government in the UK.
Really, it was that traumatizing for the country? I mean, they really stood down?
I think it was that embarrassing for the government. It caused a lot of stir at the time. But it was also at a time, 1844 is the time when the British Empire is beginning to grow, the Royal Navy in particular is beginning to grow. The intelligence that came from interception became perhaps less necessary for the conduct of state. And so things lay fallow until the time of the First World War pretty well.
I see. So that's interesting. So just to like give the corresponding, you know, rough U.S. history, and I'm obviously not an historian, you have in the 1800s, late 1800s, really, you have our U.S. Supreme Court saying that the contents of a paper letter inside the envelope are protected and can be accessed only with a proper warrant, in our case, granted by a neutral and detached magistrate on a showing of probable cause. And then as our intelligence services, you know, really ramp up in the post-World War II era with the 1947 National Security Act, you have just a massive, massive set of absolutely horrendous abuses, including, but not limited to, signals intelligence. It is just a complete set, really, of just covert action behavior directed against Americans, of interception of telegrams, the, you know, the communications mode of the day, and of letters, including of government officials in the U.S. and private parties. You have literally LSD mind control experiments being conducted on unwitting Americans by the CIA, just a raft of massive abuse by the intelligence community that no thinking person today would try to defend in any way, all of which sort of comes out in the early to mid 1970s and does not, I think, lead the US to stop or step back from signals intelligence, but does lead to a very, very severe set of new regulations and a whole new paradigm of sort of conducting intelligence under law. It feels like the US, as compared to the British experience, sort of both had more extreme kinds of abuse, more systematic abuse, more recent abuse, and then I think then a more, perhaps more significant response and change in the way we did it. So for us, really, starting in the mid-1970s, you get substantial legal controls imposed on signals intelligence to include the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, and much stronger congressional oversight, among other things. So it sounds like the Brits have a longer and maybe steadier history with more gradual change. Does that seem right to you, Tony? And Michael, I'd like to ask you whether that corresponds to your experience as well.
I'd say that in the post-Second World War era, GCHQ was an organization that put between two-thirds and three-quarters of its effort onto targeting the Soviet Union. And that primarily was the Soviet Union as a military target. So I don't say there was sort of less scope for abuse, as though there were people who were sort of desperately looking for ways that they could abuse their powers. But it just wasn't something that came up when, you know, you're really worried about a Guards army in East Germany and what's going to happen during its summer exercises. There's a lot less threat, obviously, to citizens in the United Kingdom or to anything that might happen to them. But the other thing I think too to remember about GCHQ is that it's not an organization that's based in London and hasn't been since 1950. It's based in Cheltenham, which is 100 miles away from central London, sometimes felt like being 1,000 miles away from central London. It was a tightly focused, little understood organization. Nobody really understood how GCHQ did what it did and how it produced the results that it did. And few people understood anyone from GCHQ when they tried to explain what it was that they were doing. So that distance and the technical aspect of what we did, as opposed to perhaps something that's a lot more readily understood when it comes to the work that MI5 and MI6 do, I think meant that we were just less in the public eye and we weren't being tasked to do things which might have ended up, if there were people in the organisation who were venal in any sense, and I don't believe there would be simply because of the way that recruitment and things happened. But I think we were just too far away to be getting involved in the sort of things that might be directed from the centre in that way.
There's no history, for example, of ministers directing GCHQ to collect domestic political intelligence or something like that. Letters sent from UK officials when they visit the Soviet Union writing home. That sort of thing just isn't part of your historical record.
It's not the way that the system works in the UK.
And Michael, what do you say?
It's not cricket.
It's just not cricket.
It's just not cricket. I mean, let me just then bring it back to the law a bit, because from what I tell you, there's a couple of observations, really. The first is I'm particularly impressed with the way that the royalist regimes pick up our brief and embarrassing interlude with not having a royal family in the 1650s, the people that banned Christmas. So again, it doesn't matter whether you're a republic or otherwise, you carry on doing SIGIN. The second issue is that, talking about the hiccups in the mid-19th century, plainly we learned nothing from Entick and Carrington. I only say that because all of the American lawyers listening to this will be going, what about Entick and Carrington? And the answer is plainly we learned nothing about that. And some would say that bulk collection is a reflection of that. I posed the question to the US participants as to whether or not bulk collection by the US doesn't drive a coach in 4 through Entick and Carrington, but David can answer that. And the third thing is to bring it into the 20th century. There have been laws, and I mean, the most obvious example is the Official Secrets Act of 1920, which, having learned through experience in the First World War, that access to cables was vital for collecting intelligence, mandated cable companies to provide that access in that act. And so that's, if you like, in my view, that's the kind of first modern evocation of how law mandates somebody to give you access, to allow you to have the material upon which to produce intelligence. And of course, that's obviously founded in the Zimmermann telegram, 1917. Arguably, Tony may disagree, arguably the greatest triumph ever of SIGINT in terms of what it did for the end of the First World War.
Okay, so tell us about the Zimmermann telegram, Tony and Michael, for the American audience that only vaguely recalls it from their, you know, primary school history classes, please.
Okay. In January 1917, the Germans decide that they're going to have unrestricted submarine warfare in the North Atlantic. And that will mean that all of the American ships that were transporting war material for the British and French side would be legitimate targets. And the Germans naturally thought, if they start sinking American ships, perhaps the Americans will join the war on the other side. So the German foreign minister, a man called Zimmermann, who was, well, he might as well have been barking mad for his plans to develop, decided that to keep the Americans out of the European war, he would get the Mexicans to declare war on the US.
Yes, opening the Southern Front.
And in return for certain victory, Mexico could have Texas, New Mexico, and Arizona. And if the Mexicans could persuade the Japanese to switch sides and join the Germans and Mexicans, the Japanese could have California. A man with great strategic vision, Herr Zimmermann, even if totally misplaced. The British SIGINT organization intercepted the telegram. Another example, by the way, of how perfidious Germany was at this time. Obviously, the UK stopped the Germans from sending telegrams to North America. So the Germans had to find willing dupes to carry their telegrams for them. And the telegram instructing the German ambassador in Washington to tell the German ambassador in Mexico to make this offer to the Mexican government was actually given to the American embassy in Berlin. And they're told, this is all about peace proposals that we want to make. So can you actually send it to Washington so that the Brits won't sort of stop it on its way? Of course, the Brits were reading neutral countries' telegrams as well as enemy telegrams and were intercepting and reading every American diplomatic message that transited the UK. So they found this message and realised what it said and what it meant. The important thing was, we can bring America into the war based on this. How do we actually tell the Americans, however, that this is what the telegram says without revealing to them that we're reading all of their diplomatic cables? It took a month before they could actually come up with something that would prove that this was genuine German diplomatic traffic. It was shown to the US Embassy in London. They obviously informed the State Department, which informed the President. And within 3 months, the Senate had declared war on Germany. So there is pretty well an isolationist, neutral country whose politics were turned around in 3 or 4 months. Would it have happened? Well, would it have happened anyway? If the Germans had started sinking lots of American ships, perhaps the Americans would have come into the war anyway. The Mexicans were far too wise to have anything to do with this harebrained proposal that had come from the Germans. When the news was published that this was what the telegram said, obviously journalists went straight to the German foreign minister to say to Zimmermann, is this true? I expect them to say, no, it's false. And he said, yeah, I thought it was a good idea.
So, great. It seemed like a good idea at the time.
Yeah.
So a couple of things. So one, I mean, there was real concern, I guess, in what you just said, in sort of making sure you protected sources and methods, which is an ongoing theme. And that, you know, still happens today when intelligence agencies collect something and they feel the need to use the intelligence and they don't want to, you know, reveal that they've got that mind reading satellite up in outer space that can tell you what everybody is thinking. For one thing, it might suggest countermeasures and the bad guys will all start wearing tinfoil hats to block the reader. But Michael, you said something else that I have to confess I didn't really know. And that is that the Official Secrets Act also contained a mandate to the cable companies to provide full access to British government agencies.
Yeah.
Did I get that right?
That's right. And it's beautifully put. I mean, if you look at the documents, it talks about the success which had been obtained during the First World War from access to cable companies, and the wartime regulations have permitted that. And at the end of the war, you're left in a world which is pretty uncertain still. You've had the revolution in Russia, you've got Germany and Europe in bits. And those who are intelligence officials say, so what are we going to do now? How are we going to get access to this material? The wartime regulations have gone. We need some sort of method to do it. And the obvious method is a very subtly drafted Act of Parliament. And I think that's kind of, I think that there's a great insight in that, because it shows it's not that we're going to do it on the QT for Americans, we're going to do it secretly. We're going to do it in a pretty obvious way, which allows the cable companies a basis upon which they can assist. And you see that today in the way that the law is still framed even now. So, but as you've pointed out, it's actually, you know, a really good example of protecting sources, how you use the material. And again, looking at echoes, and we may come back to it for your American listeners. I mean, we still have the ultimate protective sources issue in the UK, because we cannot use intercepted communications, whether SIGINT or by line access, as evidence in criminal proceedings. There is an absolute bar. And the Americans think we're crazy. And I think it's only us and the Zambians who have that law. So we stand in good company.
You know, you get to have whatever laws and rules your democratically elected leaders decide to pass.
Well, perhaps after the 1st of January, depending upon.
I see, right. Well, I mean, to me, it's interesting that you have SIGINT success of a very profound nature in World War I. It really helps you bring the Americans in, which can be beneficial. And, you know, it's kind of like the work of Intrepid in World War II. And then as a result of recognizing the importance of that intelligence, you actually pass a law quite early on saying that there's going to be mandated access. The U.S. experience, as I've said, is quite different. History definitely has a profound influence on our legal regulation. But a lot of collection that goes on in the U.S., especially before the mid-1970s and even to some extent thereafter, is done on a non-compelled voluntary basis. That is, there's some collection that you can compel with a court order under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act here in the U.S. There's some collection that is neither compulsory nor forbidden by FISA, and it's done under what we call Executive Order 12333. And there are provisions in U.S. law that allow the Attorney General to advise somebody that it's not forbidden for them to assist. But there's a whole range of non-compelled but permitted assistance, as well as compelled assistance. It sounds like very early on, and much earlier than the U.S. ever got around to doing any such thing, the British figured out that this is really valuable stuff, and we better just have a law that says our government agencies can have access to it. Did the Act, Michael, give any immunity to the cable companies? Did it protect them from somebody complaining or suing or challenging, or was that just not really a big concern?
I don't think that's a concern. I mean, and just by way of example, we're going to come on to it, but the first real piece of interception legislation in the UK is the Interception Communications Act 1985. Well, that legislation runs to 12 sections, three of which are interpretation sections, two of which create criminal offences, and that governs the entirety of the interception regime. So we started, you know, on the basis of keep it simple, stupid. We've moved now to the Investigatory Powers Act 2016, which has got 350 sections and more schedules than I've ever seen before in my life. And that's how the growth has taken place in that 30 years.
Yeah. Whereas we, you know, I mean, when we passed FISA in 1978, many people, including myself, have at times referred to it as, well, using another U.S. law, the ERISA of national security law, meaning the very, very, very complicated legal regime that has, well, supported tenure for many law professors, allowed persons like myself to publish books and articles, and meant that government lawyers with expertise in that field are, assured of continued employment, because it is not a simple, I would say we kept it complicated, stupid, kicks rather than kiss as our motto. And indeed, our whole legal regime is just massively complex, and the way it all works together is hard sometimes to parse through.
Lawyers should love complexity.
Exactly. As I said, I mean, many professors owe their tenure to this, and many government lawyers and authors, owe their productivity to this, but it can be hard to parse through. So looking at the sort of landscape today, I mean, just in case, you know, folks here in the United States don't fully understand, I mean, in the U.S., if I were going to sort of ride the elevator and tell you who the big intelligence agencies are, we've got a 17-member intelligence community on the theory that it takes a village and everybody's got to do their part. There's no Department of National Security in the United States. There's bits and pieces of the national security pie sliced and diced in various fashions and organized and led and coordinated in various ways. But if I'm in the elevator, I say, look, FBI doing both domestic law enforcement and counterintelligence, leading there, CIA doing human intelligence abroad, and NSA doing signals intelligence. If I have to just go with three, I'd go with those three. I think I know what the British counterpart would be, but can you guys together tell us a little bit about who does what in Great Britain today in the field? Where does James Bond work? It's really what I want to know.
Elstree Studios.
Outstanding. Okay.
You've got the Secret Intelligence Service, MI6, and MI5, the Security Service. They were both founded in 1909. The Secret Service Bureau was founded in 1909. And in October 1910, the two members of the Secret Service Bureau, recognizing that one was more interested in what foreigners were doing overseas and the other was more interested in what foreigners were trying to do in the UK, decided to divvy up the work in that way. And that's really the origins of the missions of each of those two organizations.
Is there an MI1 through 4? I mean, what happened? Did those get tried and just failed? Or why did they start at MI5?
They didn't. There was an MI1, believe it or not. I think, God knows, they went up to about MI19 or something like that. I wouldn't worry too much about nomenclature.
Okay. So 5 and 6 split up domestic and foreign, more or less, in the UK, the way CIA and FBI, roughly speaking, in the US.
Though domestic also included the colonies, and in the Age of Empire, that obviously gave MI5 responsibilities all over the globe. The big difference you should remember between the UK intelligence community and the US intelligence community is size, scale, and budget. We can't afford, for example, to have separate SIGINT organizations in the UK, or separate intelligence services, each doing SIGINT by themselves using their own systems. So the closer you've got to technology, the more MI5 and MI6 have had traditionally to depend on GCHQ to support their missions. In the same way as in caricature, MI6 people would say about GCHQ that our place was like a factory full of men with brown overalls who were just working on a production line.
Is that what they say about you?
Yeah.
That's very sweet. And what do you say in return, sir?
We would say that they were people for whom the fountain pen was cutting edge technology.
Oh, great. Because it, for a minute there, it started to sound like you were going to tell me that the intelligence services of the United Kingdom all work and play well together, as compared to the backstabbing knife fight in a dark alley that characterizes the U.S. Interagency experience from time to time, or so I've been told. But I'm glad that we didn't go down that path. And I appreciate the fountain pen reference. I will say that what some intelligence agencies say about the federal BI in the United States is that their motto is yesterday's technology, tomorrow. And at times that's been proven to be the case, but I neither confirm nor deny it, nor do I endorse it one way or the other. So one of the differences, though, that Michael referred to earlier between the US and the UK is that, say, the FBI, the rough analog to FIVE, is also a law enforcement agency. It's both a counterintelligence security type service, and after 9/11 really tried to be more of a security service as it had been at various times in its past. But we here in the 13 colonies do use electronic surveillance information, signals intelligence, as evidence in criminal trials and in other settings as well. And we have elaborate mechanisms for providing notice to somebody that, good news, the government's going to introduce information from electronic surveillance against you in the upcoming proceeding that we're going to be doing together, whether that's a criminal trial or a civil proceeding. And so, Michael, tell us, you guys really don't do that in Britain.
No, we don't. And to go back to Tony's point, I mean, I think until the 1990s, there was no history of GCHQ doing work in support of law enforcement or acting to prevent or detect serious crime. Just to go back a bit, I mean, until the 1960s, really, interception wasn't spoken about at all.
Just polite people didn't bring it up.
No, absolutely. It's not dinner party conversation.
Outside the Overton window.
And exactly. And so what you have is you have a series of scandals in the 1950s where somebody is revealing the fact of interception of a known criminal in London. It gets released to his lawyer. There's a lawyer involved. Inevitably, the lawyer misuses the information or tells his client. So there's a big investigation. And basically, everyone says, there's no legislation, but it's fine. It works administratively. Leave it alone. So it's not until you get to the 1980s where you get this first issue. And again, there's another criminal law case where the person says, by that time, we're heavily into the European Convention on Human Rights. And the individual, a man called Malone, brings a case to the European Court of Human Rights. And effectively, the British argument is the requirement under the ECHR that an invasion of privacy of this nature has to be in compliance with the law is met because there is no law, which I love as a legal argument. Unsurprisingly,
we have not violated any rules here.
Absolutely. There are no rules to violate. And it's an argument I've used myself in negotiations with the EU in a different place. But let's put that aside for a second. And so the result is that the Strasbourg court, the ECHR, doesn't really like that. So we're forced to legislate, which we do in 1985. At the same time, there's the beginning of avowal of security service in 1989. And eventually, SIS, MI6, and GCHQ realize they have to follow suit. So in 1994, you've got this first Intelligence Service Act, which says there is something called GCHQ. Interestingly, the words of the statute say there shall continue to be a government communications headquarters. It's a rather elegant solution, actually.
It is. I mean, we do get a National Security Agency Act in the United States, but as a practical matter, for a very long time, the NSA is understood to stand for no such agency, and they keep what you would say is a very low profile. They are not particularly good in this period at what one would call public relations, and in some ways, they're sort of forced into it in a different way after mid-2013, thanks to one of their alums. And, in some ways, I think they are still very much struggling with the extent to which they need to build popular support for the value of what they do and the sort of safety and efficacy of what they do. But it's different, and we've talked about this many times. I mean, it's really different in the UK. Both of you, I think, have the feeling that over time, historically and even today, there just is and remains broad popular support for SIGINT and intelligence agencies generally. And that just by no means is consistent with US experience over time and today, right?
Yes, absolutely. I'll come to that in a sec. So the point about the 1994 Act is on its face, it says that GCHQ can support the prevention and detection of serious crime as well as producing intelligence and acting in the interest of national security, are equivalent of foreign intelligence to some extent. So you've got that first sort of obvious and public recognition that here is an organisation whose enormous resources and skills can be leveraged to assist the effort against serious and organised crime. And of course, you're in the mid-90s. You haven't yet arrived at the point of fighting wars in Mesopotamia. You're not there. What you are is you've got the Balkans. You've got the erosion of the Russian threat. So you want to use the resources. Let's put them into serious and organised crime. So that's where you are. Coming to your second point about popular support, there were some public surveys done after the errant son of the NSA made the revelations that he did. The results of those surveys seemed to be that two-thirds of people thought that either there was nothing wrong with the powers being exercised to protect national security through intelligence, and of that, a significant number thought that more powers were needed. So again, it comes more powers. So you get back to the point, which is that there's popular support for a whole range of historical reasons. Tony can talk about that. But there's also the realization, I think, that there's a balance and you're not brought up in the same way you are as an American kid with what 1776 was all about, the overweening influence of the federal government, how you should push against that, what probable cause is, Entick and Carrington, if you're a lawyer. That doesn't really form part of our psyche. And because of that, we're happy to allow the government a good measure of discretion in what it does.
And Tony, has that always been the case, do you think, historically? Has it waxed and waned, or how does it play out historically for the UK?
It was interesting because sort of thinking about this question, you know, you can look at the British experience of Irish terrorism and say that people were aware of why there would be a surveillance apparatus. But thinking about it in the late 1960s, before Irish terrorism had really got going, there was a revelation in the Daily Express of the fact that the cable companies were handing over copies of all of the telegrams that were being sent. The paper got it slightly wrong. It said it was being handed over to the Ministry of Defence rather than to GCHQ. And there was a small scandal, after which nothing changed, except administratively. Though it literally was a sort of three-day wonder. The revelations were made. Prime Minister said in Parliament that everything was being done properly. The slight change that happened subsequently was that ministers gave the 6-monthly approval to the renewal of the warrants that were in operation at that time, rather than officials. But otherwise, nothing changed.
Okay, so that is just so different, right? So the analog in the US is, you know, Operation Shamrock by the NSA, intercepting telegrams before and after that period. And it's, again, part of the revelations that come out in the mid-1970s. And it is a huge, huge galvanizing moment for the US, in which public opinion and elite opinion converge into a relatively narrow band. It's sort of one of only two such periods in my lifetime, the other one being 9/11 and pointing very much in the other direction. And there is a massive legislative and regulatory response to that. So again, there's one big difference is perhaps the scope of the abuse and the reaction to it. And the other, as you say, is, you know, until 9/11, the US doesn't have the same kind of experience with international terrorism, foreign-based terrorism occurring on its soil. And we have sort of domestic terrorism in the late 60s and 70s, but I don't think it's as searing an experience for us as the Troubles and related Irish issues are for you guys in the UK. Maybe those are the two big differences.
Well, the other one that affects our partners in Europe is that, with the exception of the Swedes, every single country either suffered under its own totalitarian dictatorship or was invaded and conquered by a totalitarian dictatorship. So the starting point in Germany, for example, when you talk about the need for security intelligence, is what you mean, like the Gestapo, like the Stasi. Oh, no, we're not like that at all. there's a sort of very different psychological effect in most European countries that will look at intelligence agencies as always having at least the potential to be oppressive. And I think that's where having a legal framework in which we can act and be trusted to act is so important. It wasn't as necessary years ago, but it's not a bad thing that a structure like that should exist.
And leaping ahead, that's what you see in, you know, the explosion of European Union interest in this area. One of the fundamental underpinnings of the data protection regime and what it means for privacy for European citizens, the philosophy of the Court of Justice of the European Union, it's all there, which is why, in a sense, we as a nation have found it, and I'm not trying to be profound about this, have found it difficult to understand why European institutions dominated by France, Germany, and other nations on the mainland of Europe, the courts have reacted the way they have and used data protection as a vehicle to ensure that the type of things Tony's been talking don't ever happen again. We just don't have that same experience.
And I don't mean to bring up a sore subject, but I gather you've given some serious consideration to, how shall I put it, Brexiting the Union. So what is going to happen? Maybe we can convert this to the lightning round as I ask you a series of impossible questions as we draw to the end of our time. What is going to happen post-Brexit, if you can just get that last bit done, you know, with respect to EU standards and British standards? Because I know we're having a little bit of an issue here in the colonies, but what about for Britain?
Okay. Well, we're all going to eat fish because we're going to reclaim our fishing waters is what's going to happen.
I see.
But apart from that,
so big economic
it's very hard to predict, and this is a whole nother podcast, but there's another things going on, really. And the first is the UK, after the 1st of January, and it almost doesn't matter what the arrangements are, going to be able to handle data of individuals which comes from Europe? And the simplest way to think about it for an American audience is that the European standards applicable to data follow the data wherever it goes. And that's whether it's here or whether it's to you. And then what the European law requires is that there is effectively not the same, it doesn't have to be the same, but it has to be an equivalent measure of protection for the data. And so because of various court cases recently as October, because of the, I would even go so far as neuralgia about the 1233 and FISA and so on and so forth, there is real concern in Europe about whether data can be protected in an adequate way. What's going to happen? I think we move to a position in which we're going to be like you and regarded as, if you like, pariahs, might not be too hard a way to put it, by the European Union institutions.
You're not going to be invited to tea? That's fair. Because after Schrems 2, I mean, obviously we are specifically found to be inadequate. We have been found wanting. And I will say, as of this moment here in sort of mid to late December 2020, there's considerable pessimism, I believe, in the U.S., you know, intelligentsia and others in this community as to whether we can avoid a Thelma and Louise moment where the where the vehicle just goes right over the edge of the cliff. Nobody wants to just sort of stop transatlantic trade, but it does seem like we've got, I guess, a bit of a sticky wicket right now. And so I guess you think maybe you're going to be in the same predicament over there in the UK once you've completed your...
I think it's inevitable. I mean, the point is this, that in October, there was a significant judgment by the Court of Justice of the European Union effectively saying that the fact that you're acting in a national security context where you're acting and speaking, again, it goes back to the point about providers and cable companies, as were, but telecoms providers, we are acting with them, you have to comply with EU law. And the implication being that the UK's SIGIN effort was not in compliance with UK law. That's effectively what underpins the Schrems judgment concerning the Privacy Shield and the striking down of those privacy shield arrangements, as far as the US is concerned, it doesn't comply with US law. So you can see why I say we're in a very similar boat. My own view, it's a purely personal view, is trade will overcome politics.
Right. Okay. And I do think, as I say, looking at the standing at the edge of the abyss and looking over it saying, oh, wow, we're really not going to do this. We're not going to transmit data back and forth. That could really hurt. Tony, sometimes lawyers like Michael and myself have tremendous virtues, so many that it's almost impossible to recount them all. But one possible risk is that we're looking at things from close to and getting into all the nitty-gritty horrible details, and we're not having a wide enough perspective on this. So looking at this Schrems, GDPR, Brexit situation with, you know, a longer-term perspective and a wider aperture, do you see a way that we can get out of this? Are there long-term forces that might help us find a solution? Are we overstating the crisis? Are you worried? Tell us about how you think about all this.
I must admit, I'm still reeling from hearing you, David, using the words, we are inadequate. But there we are.
Loyalty. I myself am reeling from neuralgia. Okay. That Michael used, and I'm going to be using that now for the rest of the week for 100% sure.
I wonder, and this is me now, I'm retired, I'm not a member of GCHQ, I'm most definitely not a lawyer. I wonder if some of this argument sounds to me like some of the argument around encryption. Okay. And
you want to go there.
Well, I wonder, is there a false dichotomy, or rather the them and us that you're describing is sort of people who believe in, you know, the absolute necessity to protect the citizen and therefore allow the citizen to use whatever encryption he wants versus the deep state, which wants to be able to read every email and listen into every WhatsApp conversation. And I think the actual difference is between a bunch of moon-howling libertarians and the odd terrorist on the one side, and on the other side, a whole bunch of ordinary people who say, of course, if there is, for example, a terrorist attack being planned, the authorities need to be able to monitor what's going on. And the question is really not whether there should be a line or not, but where the line should be drawn. You know, obviously, digital societies need strong encryption. Obviously, if you know there are terrorists planning to carry out an attack somewhere, the authorities need to be able to access what they're doing and produce intelligence on them. So the discussions should be about what is it that you're trying to enable and how would you do that? He says, not being a lawyer, not being a public servant anymore, rather than focusing, as you say, on the nitty-gritty of, but what does Article 14, Section 8, Clause, 8, Bravo, actually mean when you apply it to something?
I mean, so Michael and I are going out of business then. That's very disturbing, Tony. I utterly reject your point of view, and I think it's desperately important to have high-priced legal advice on the nitty-gritty at all times.
But yeah, but what we'll do is we'll create some new nitty-gritty.
Tony, after this call, I'm going to send you a judgment from the CJEU as a early Christmas present.
Oh, wow, okay. All heart.
That is very sweet of you. So, okay, so Tony went there, and I, we're going to have a little lightning round at the end where I do invite you to say things that you'll regret later. But encryption. So, Michael, U.S. intelligence agencies gaze across the ocean to the Investigatory Powers Act and other legislative authority in the United Kingdom with some degree of jealousy and latent rage. And they think, wow, we are really having trouble here, especially the FBI thinks, we're really having trouble here with encrypted communications and devices and so forth. And look at the magnificent powers that our British brothers and sisters enjoy to issue technical notices that require providers to produce plain text. And yet, As far as the public record shows, the British government has not apparently been terribly aggressive in using and enforcing this perceived legal authority. So what's your take on that as a guy who follows this pretty closely?
That's because the FUBI see us through rose-tinted spectacles.
Okay, the FUBI? Is that the FUBI? See, I can call them the federal BI because of raising Arizona, but the FUBI. Okay, so they see the world through rose-colored spectacles when it comes to the UK, so it's not so great,
I think
great,
they do,
huh?
Because it seems to me that when you look at a proper assessment of the UK law, means that if the material is sensibly available on Claire to a person who's in receipt of a notice, then they can be compelled to give it to the authorities in those circumstances. There's no general power to require encryption. There's a very specific power if you get arrested and you've got a laptop under your arm for the authorities to say, give me the password, and you say no, and then you can be prosecuted for a separate offence for not giving the password. And that's the sanction. But there's no general power to require encryption, and that's not how I read the IPA at all. And as you point out, what you haven't seen, query, will you ever see it, is an attempt to use the statutory powers as they are to require a telecoms provider to provide Enclare material which isn't otherwise available to them on Claire. Well, we've not seen it thus far. In 2020, we haven't seen it since this really became an issue more than 15 years ago.
And you don't think we're going to see it because you don't think they really have confidence they've got the authority to do it? Is that what you're trying to say?
Well, I look forward to being instructed in the case.
Okay. I bet you look forward to being retained in the case on behalf of the communications provider and going to town.
I'm available for hire.
Okay, very good. And if you need an expert witness on the history of signals intelligence, I believe one Tony Comer can be engaged at a reasonable rate. And so it could be a very, very lucrative package deal. All right, gentlemen, we are coming to the end of our available time. Let me just do the lightning rounds. As we conduct this podcast, there is a big thing brewing right now about the SolarWinds hack. Do either or both of you care to offer an opinion now in the absence of a fully developed record where you say something that you will later regret saying about SolarWinds? Is there any lesson that we can draw from it right now?
I have spent a number of years observing how the US objects to the UN General Assembly introducing a treaty to prevent hacking across the borders proposed by the Russians. I think the irony is quite interesting.
Okay, Tony, you want to frame that in a historical context for us? Is it true that nation states conduct espionage against other nation states from time to time?
I agree with my legal friend.
Okay. And this being a podcast about UK SIGINT, then, let me ask, have either of you had a chance yet to make sense of the latest round of back and forth in respect of the UK's online harms debate that's ongoing? Do you have a feeling for where that one's headed?
I've not been following it particularly closely because the principle underpinning the Harms Act is one that makes absolute sense. The difficulty is when you actually try and define exactly what it is that you want to do, exactly who's going to do it, exactly how they're going to do it. It's part of the problem of, I think, creating any sort of legislation around modern technology. You can take a snapshot of exactly what capabilities there are here, now, today, knowing full well that by the time you've debated what you want to do, technology is going to have moved on. So I've no idea how it will pan out at all.
Michael?
There's an obvious desire and need to do something both in the UK and in the EU. Is this the right thing to do? I doubt it. Is it too intrusive into service providers' actions? Probably yes. Will it be enforced properly, and how do you enforce it, assuming it passes? I think it's the really interesting question. How are you going to know?
All right. Well, I think we will leave it there. Gentlemen, thank you very much. The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Please share the Lawfare podcast and give us a 5-star review on iTunes, a 6-star review if that's possible. Go to thelawfarestore.com for brand new Lawfare pens, lanyards, t-shirts, and socks. The podcast is edited by Jen Patya Howell, and your audio engineer is Zachary Frank of Goat Rodeo. Thank you, Zachary. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan, and as always, thank you for listening.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.